Right, today it's an interview with two members of the GUM team. Jerry Hillman, who does the layout and also does a bit of serious dialoguing at the end of the end of the process, when he and Craig Gibson, the editor, meet up and just try and cram all the words they've got into the broadsheet. You were just saying before we started recording that when you're doing the final layout, it comes to the editorial and that's when Craig actually writes it.
I mean, although I sign it, I mean, we pretty much write it together. So
there's always much more work gets submitted to Craig than what actually fits on the page. Craig doesn't necessarily know what the flavour of the issue is, because, to be honest, I know it probably sounds like it takes away from Craig's power as editor, but if there are certain stories that instantly, perhaps there's no room. Like, quite often someone might submit a wonderful story, but it'll take up most of the back page, and so there's certainly no way you can publish it because it's just too long, there's no space. The practical decisions can affect the flavour of the issue. That's why the introduction has to be written last.
Well, there's definitely a discipline in the constraints of the design, the fact of having it as a broadsheet. Do you enjoy having that discipline, Craig?
Yep. You could get a wee bit lost otherwise. You could. I mean, we have changed it slightly for this new volume. It used to be, for the benefit of people that can't see, I'm folding the paper here. It used to be six columns on either side, but we've changed that to four now. This is actually a bit nicer for prose. Not so good for poetry because it just takes up a hell of a lot of room.
And so I take it that you're not an automatic sort of reverential devotee of white space?
I call it dead space, but I'm not scared of it, no. When we first changed the format to the slightly bigger masthead and whatnot, and we had like pretty much the whole front page of it would be just an illustration. I was a window dresser in a previous incarnation, and I was always told by my master never to fear the dead space. It can actually be something you can use in a way. So
yeah, when I first
that was
started,
like Star Wars, that was.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, so Yoda told you that. Like, when I first started doing desktop publishing and whatnot, there was a bit of a real fashion, especially among like magazine and supplement designers. I started work at Scotsman. That was my first ever job from school. By total luck and nepotism, ended up basically being a sort of apprentice desktop publishing person at the Scotsman, and there's a bit of a fashion then for the, like, you know, like white a creative use of white space, they called it. But I think that assumes a much greater quantity of space to fill. I mean, we have to get value for money after all, to an extent, out of the just one A2 sheet folded. So how much you might like to spread things out and make a really beautiful aesthetic with a lot of white space, you simply, there's just that would just been.
I would say also, I think probably like the very first volume that we did, the very first four, I mean, they were very, they looked very Victorian.
Very and, densely wordy.
And they were very densely wordy, yeah. So people didn't really complain, but said, it's a bit heavy on the eyes. So we thought, you know, it wouldn't do any harm to break it up a little bit.
I mean, we're very lucky because we've got this informal arrangement with Lucy McKenzie, the illustrator, who not only is a very highly regarded international painter and an artist, but also as an illustrator, she tends to, as we can, again, for the benefit of the listener, you know, as you see, it's a very light type of illustration style that she has. She doesn't tend to fill in big blocks with dark, so it sort of saves us even defining too much space design-wise.
I think that there's a character to the gun, but I can't quite put my finger on it. I'm trying to think what it would be. I mean, is it a satirical broadsheet?
Well, I think the main thing is, one of the main places that we put the gun is pubs, as Jerry was saying earlier, or cafes and galleries and that kind of thing. And it should be that anyone that actually just enjoys reading should be able to pick it up and read it. So you'll get, occasionally you'll get the higher brow stuff. But I certainly specialise in the lower brow of the brows, so to speak. So, if we're talking brows here. But there's poetry in it and whatnot too. So it should be, it's rare that anyone will read it from, you know, both sides and say they enjoyed every bit of it. I'd be very, very surprised. So there should be a wee bit for everyone in there, I think.
But I think what you're saying, Jenny, is more almost that despite the fact that it changes style and the words are always different, there's some sort of overriding feel. There must be a lot of us in it that maybe we can't even see. We just think, I'm thinking, oh God, this is so different looking and so different to read from the issue two, the first one that we've done together. Mm. But then to an outside person looking at it, it's like completely unified because obviously it's me and Craig sort of doing it. So I think that really is just perhaps what you're talking about, is just the simple personality mainly of Craig and a little bit of me and of certain
and of all the writers as well.
Only certain contributors that have been constant like partners during that time, because originally there was another person, a chap called Mark Jardine, who was involved and wrote some very interesting articles, but a much more historical, from a much more intellectual kind of standpoint, that I would say we realised didn't fit with the way that we were seeing it as something more relaxed, kind of enjoyable, yeah. Half hour in the pub, pick it up in the cafe, read it as you wait for the pasta to boil, something a bit more recreational as well, whereas I think he saw it as maybe thinking cap on, almost like university library, silence, let's read the gun, but I think our vision of it's a bit more relaxed than that. You know, I certainly hope so.
Big, are you doing it out of some sort of altruism where you just want to keep people happy and mildly amused in pubs?
I would say but obviously there'll be something deep down which isn't that at all. But no, I like the fact that it is free. So technically we are encouraging people to read a bit more, maybe. So what was the question?
No, but have you ever had a kind of dark night of the soul when you've lain there and thought, why am I doing this?
Oh, aye, yeah.
And what is it you think when you think that?
I wake up in the morning sober, so.
But then, if you have the kind of bright night of the soul, and you think, "Well, no,
if folk come up to me and say they've enjoyed it, that's good, you know. That really does cheer me up. And I think what we're doing just is kind of right. I don't know if there's anything quite like us, so I think we have filled a bit of a niche.
It's not also simply. It's like being in a band. It's bloody good fun.
Hmm.
It's actually bloody good fun, there's no point pretending otherwise. It's like, you know, I imagine it's extremely good fun when someone, you know, you ask them for a submission or whatever, and someone sends you something really cool and you go, oh, this is really great, and I would like this if it existed and I wasn't part of it, so it's nice to be part of bringing that into existence. That's like being in a band, there's some music that you'd listen to if you weren't making it, and so instead you make it because it doesn't exist.
Are you particularly interested in sort of singers, songwriters as such? Do you ever write lyrics?
No, never have done. I mean, I never really liked poetry either. In fact, the only poem I've ever written was, again, it was a kind of rant against the Arts Council, so...
It was a poem?
Yeah, well, I managed to intrude it into a story, but...
But I just wondered if that would be the case, because... is it William Douglas?
William Douglas, yeah.
I think we both share the view that it's really, really good. Mm. Well, he writes his lyrics, doesn't he?
Yeah.
And he writes his own music as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
What I hope happens with the gun is where, like, technical expertise or technical excellence coincides with like a winning personality sort of thing. And I think you could do nice desert publishing and make a nice design of a thing like the gun, but it could be just totally boring. Or you could have really interesting words and have it presented on a crap photocopy and it'd be like a punk era fanzine or something. Whereas you get a mixture and it just happens to really work really well, and that happens with the gun and with William Douglas, because he's an extremely good guitarist, has a very nice voice, but he doesn't just go down the line of using those in a totally straightforward way. So you get a really nice, like, a synergy between the technical excellence and the nice personality.
Yeah, superb. I know you've both got your hands of Stella, which is obviously the favourite.
Yeah, for the benefit of those who can't see, we're both drinking Stella Artois. Yeah,
perhaps.
Well, we'd love one. A while back, we thought it'd be nice to get maybe. I really thought the Tennent's Lager logo. You know, I'd never ever drink Tennent's unless under duress at a party or something. It'd be quite nice on it, but I quite like the fact it's never had anything like that. And back to one of my personal things, I'm very, very proud it's never had the Scottish Arts Council logo on it. even though that. Maybe my pride has cost me some cash, I don't know.
From my point of view, it's quite nice that the gun can operate quite happily without that. And, you know,
it's a more underground one as well, or at least everyone seems to be skint on it. I don't know what I mean, you're underground, but, you know, things like what Anita Govan does at the Beatniks, and you've got Big Word, Jerry Lindsay's Big Word, and Craig Duffy was doing some good stuff down in Leith. But anyway, that's another, and I've met quite a lot of people through that as well. I mean, you kind of tend to go to these things, you meet people. I kind of think when the UNESCO thing was set up, so they should have been given a big sum of money, God knows who, but then for just solely for literature, and that should have been made separate from the rest of the arts, like opera or visual arts or anything like that. I think a separate literature body should have been set up to merit being the very first city of literature. Now, I don't know the ins and outs.
So you quite believe in the city of literature as an idea?
Aye, yeah. Well, I think we deserve it.
But isn't it just a marketing slogan? Much more than that?
Well, it is to an extent, but there's so much we can be proud of as well at the same time.
Weren't we already without it?
Oh, I see, in that respect.
Why did we need UNESCO to say something for approval?
Of course, you never need that stuff. And all these things look outside of Edinburgh far too much. They're trying to impress the world, you know. And what Edinburgh needs and what I think we do is completely aimed at all year round, something fun that's for and about Edinburgh. And these UNESCO things and that, well, that's all wonderful. I'm obviously glad if people look at Edinburgh and say, the city's full of good writing, and whether that's Irvine Welsh or Robert Louis Stevenson, and it's all good and it's all shit we should be proud of. But we should also be saying, right, the festival's over, the book festival's over, all this stuff's out of the way. It's now November and it's a pissing rain, but there still has to be arts and nice stuff going on. And I think that's sort of what we tap into. I hope what we tap into.
Well, I think it is. And I think in that way, it's like, you know, the guy who runs the jazz bar, Bill Kyle.
Yeah.
Now, he's setting that up as a place, as a venue for literary things.
And it seems to be quite good. There's quite a lot of stuff going
on. There's a lot of different things
going
on. So he's going to have... He had the Thirsty Lunches last year. They were great. And he's having them again this year. He's got Beatniks. He's got Big Word. You know, if everything was encompassed within a corporate group, it would mean the life had gone out of the whole scene. And you actually just need things happening in that sort of spontaneous way.
When Edinburgh actually got the award, I remember writing a particularly snidey little commentary somewhere buried in the middle of the paper, saying there'd be much dancing in the streets of Merkeston tonight.
You know, if you took this to the study programme, the Dragon's Den, you know, where this is where you have to pitch your idea, your business concept to these entrepreneurs to invest.
Panel.
Sir Alan Sugar.
Well, that's not that one.
That's the Apprentice.
One.
But
and the panel are quite tough at the end.
Yeah, no, but the panel each are like billionaires, so they they'll invest. The idea is you go in and you say, "I've invented this thing
it's
that
gone.
Makes." I've invented this machine. Folding broadsheet. I'm pitching you for £10,000 for a 50% share in my business, whatever. So you pitch them, and then they ask you questions. What's your profit margins? All this blah blah. And they either invest or they don't. But you couldn't possibly. There's no business model behind this. The thing can exist. So long as we don't need to give it more than two, three days every quarter to actually produce it, it doesn't really matter.
Well, I have to say, I'm very proud of it. Pretty much every issue we bring out, I've been very proud of.
And the problem is like any of these things, you'd feel like a right prick if you stopped now. Mm. I would anyway. If I said,
I agree. Like, we don't go out of our way to make enemies, but I think we have made them, and I wouldn't give them the satisfaction of saying, ha ha ha. Yeah.
Totally.
Are you sure you don't go out of your way to make enemies?
No, I don't really. No. I just get a bit too intoxicated at the wrong events.
Yeah, yeah.
And shoot my mouth off a wee bit.
Well, I don't know, I think it was you. I heard about, I think it was one of the first City of Literature things. Did you sort of declaim a poem at one of them? I think you did. Standing on a table, perhaps?
No, that was my friend Graham Brodie.
Yeah, was that?
Now, whoever it was, I thought that was really good, particularly since whoever it was that mentioned it to me, and I really can't remember who it was going on about inappropriate behaviour.
It's very, very Morningside tea room kind of mentality.
Oh, is that that thing?
Rory's behaviour was totally appropriate because he's on the table declaiming, and Graham,
and the man's a genius. Yeah. If you listen to, I mean, he's an absolutely phenomenal poet who we've published probably more than any other individual in terms of articles per issue, and he jumped up on stage and read a fantastic poem.
Not even sit on the table
on a bunch of tables at the front of
and
the
declaimed
room, and declaimed the poem. It must have lasted a matter of seconds. The thing was that there were a bunch of like real school teacher type looking guys tutting tweed jackets, brogues, and that tutting as Graham did this. It's like, what? You can't listen to a fucking poem for 2 minutes? This is a literary establishment.
Yeah.
You can't listen to a fucking poem for 2 minutes.
Well,
what's this? You know? The Guns production and whatever. is so totally booze southern as well. It's like from the sort of I think probably still most pubs during the day, you'd find during the day you'd find the majority of it being mostly men in the pub. During the day,
it's kind of aimed at the daytime drinker, so yeah, the they tend to be men, unfortunately.
What was what they said?
But I don't know. It's a sodden paper, so yeah, that's probably the best way to approach it.
Are you into
binge drinking? Yeah.
Tchaikovsky.
Bukowski. Kind of. I'm not a huge fan, but I've read his.
I'm actually not. Weirdly, I think he's quite.
I liked one called. I think it was Post Office. Maybe.
I've only read a couple of maybe two collections of writings, and I find them quite possibly quite samey in terms of. I got me drunk. I slapped the woman. I was angry. It's like, dude. Honestly, have a bit of fun. Yeah, doesn't sound like fun. But waking up angrily, opening a bottle of whiskey, taking a huge slug.
No, horrible. It's always wine.
wine, really cheap wine. So this pouring, there's only this beard and that horrible wine dreadlocks in his beard.
But guys, you know, I don't know who's your favourite writer, Jack.
Oh, what a horrible question.
I know, that's what I asked you. Just to make you squirm on the spot. Favourite book, then?
I suppose, like, the official favourite book is, like, the official favourite album. It's not the one that's actually... The one that you think has the most value for answering that question, I suppose, probably be, like, Tin Drum or Catch 22.
Catch 22?
They're really, like, blokey choices. I know that's real, like, bloke choices, but...
Yeah, mine's just House of the Green Shutters. That's not, like, a bird's book. It's not chick lit, you know. House of the Green Shutters? It's a nasty piece of work.
I really like
Dragged Scotland kicking and screaming nastily into the 20th century.
Thinking about it, in some ways, someone like maybe Alistair Gray is a real good one. Because he's like alive now and his stuff has a sort of aliveness for me because it's more of this era. Sort
Are you log rolling though? Because we've published
it
before. Log rolling here now?
No, I actually noticed that a book up there by him and I thought, yeah, God, I do like Alistair Gray a lot. I like Will Self, he's good.
I tell you, a big hero of mine's James Herbert, the horror writer, Britain's Stephen King. For the benefit of everyone, I just did the italic marks there. Stephen King.
I love Graham Greene. I read loads of really good Graham Greene books recently. It's had a real thing of them because I really got into going to the Turkish baths. There's this Turkish bath down in Portobello in the swimming pool. Me and my girlfriend go there all the time. Mm. And like part of the fun is that you can lie after going to the steam room. You can lie in these warm rooms and read for hours. But what you don't want to do is bring a new book there. So I've got really into buying paperbacks from the local charity shops to me.
What, because it's getting damp?
Yeah, they get damp. They fall apart. They get totally... So you've got to buy one for the minimum possible cost. And you can always get a Graham Greene for like 30p out of a chest, heart and stroke on Easter Road. So I've read hundreds of them now. Really good. Some of them are some really great books.
Jeremy's also saying that he wanted, you know, well, the idea is about getting almost like a gentleman's club in the sort of baths.
Yeah, yeah.
In the papers or so on. Yeah.
Discussing important stories of the day from the paper as your newspaper.
As
your newspaper.
Being alternative to the pub, you know, we'll have a chat in the sort of what would you call that?
All the rooms have names.
No, it's Latin names or something.
Yeah, but they're all written in, like, on these Edinburgh Council little plaques on the wall, because it's in the actual swimming pool in Portobello. So the hot room, I can't remember what that's called, but there's the hottest room is the Laconicum, which is, like, obviously you get all laconic, you got all that all... There's the Caldarium, which is, obviously, hot. There's Caldus, whatever it is in Latin. There's a Frigidarium, which is a cold room. I've forgotten what the other room is. Like the warm sort of room.
Like the Humidarium.
Could you mean that? No, I'm not even sure. And there's this mad steam room. And there's an ice-cold plunge pool as well. It's an amazing scene down there. And there's a lot of Sikh guys go there on a Friday. So you get this really good vibe.
There's a Cottagerium.
There's not. Well, there's a men-only day on a Tuesday. But you get a fantastic... All these Sikh guys, this huge gang of them, they're just such a good laugh. They just, like, tell jokes. They're really comfortable in this environment for some reason. So you get a really good laugh. It's quite relaxing. Whereas other times...
Their beards.
Yeah, they let their hair down.
Yeah.
hit the turban off, really like head onto head.
Yeah.
It's brilliant. It's a brilliant place.
They used to have, before it got done up down there in Portobello, it had a jacuzzi that looked like, in the Sunday Post, used to get pictures of people being caught and put into pots to be sort of stewed alive. Yeah. And
Was a thing over it?
Like no, I never had a lid.
No,
well, it had a, no, it didn't have a lid.
Uncle,
but it was a great,
that.
Great big metal
thing.
No,
it is. It's like a huge washing machine.
It's like
a
washing machine.
The big, huge twin top washing machine thing, it looks like. Yeah.
And they let me and my friend go in together.
Yeah.
For half price. Yeah, it's very good.
And they do, because me and my girlfriend were asking about it. They were like, you can go in, you can share the cost for an hour.
Oh, everyone got that. I just thought it was especially privileged.
I mean, I was completely off the point by a million miles here. Me and Kate was laughing, going, what? So we went to go in there together, and they were giving us a room in a municipal building to go in together as a shots. That's a genius concept. I mean, obviously, we were like, nah, thanks, let's go to the Turkish bath. I was quite freaked out by the permissiveness of this concept.
It's okay, guys, I'm holding the interview together. Now, we have strayed slightly from the path here. Yeah? Municipal things.
Anyway, you were asking about a film.
Well, let's talk about George Orwell then.
Oh, yeah, we're talking about
1984. It's one of the scariest books I've ever read.
We're talking about that in the pub.
That kept me awake.
We
were. We really were. And I was saying that to Jerry. It kept me awake for about 3 weeks when I read it.
I think what my favourite book
I was trying to work out if it could actually happen, and it could.
My favourite book is...
doesn't certain parts of the world, dude. That kind of... making the whole population insane.
Yeah.
My
favourite book is Labyrinths by George Luis Borges. That's the best book ever. It's amazing and just completely...
Are you familiar with this one?
Yeah.
I'm not actually.
That's
so
right. Just absolutely great. Just great.
You best tell me and the unseen listener.
It's just a great collection of trippy little short stories. But it's just like, when you hear the idea of magic realism or something, you imagine something more like this. When when you read a magic realist book, it's like realist, and then magic stuff just happens. But this is more like just the intrinsic magic and in stuff that goes on. It's just really great, like people remembering things or books that you've read or misunderstandings or that thought that how different would the universe be if you just put the pen down a different bit of the desk or some slight different change could have these huge cosmic knock-on effects. It's great. It's really, really good.
Also, I really love American Psycho, but weirdly I link that back to Moby Dick in a weird way. Because American Psycho, it's not really a straightforward like narrative. It's all these bits and bits and bits. And I think Moby Dick's really like that. I bet Bret Easton Ellis was quite into Moby Dick when he was at uni or something. Because that kind of thing, it's like scenes that have nothing to do with the plot whatsoever. I mean, Moby Dick, the hunt for the whale is very, very small. That's why I love it so much. It's all about, I don't know, other things, really.
That's exactly it.
Because the film Moby Dick's like, there she goes and that. But the book's nothing like that. I mean, that's only a tiny wee bit of the book, you know.
Do you think that a writer could ever be a happy person, really? Or do you think that
writers
a
happy person?
Have to be at least quite substantially...
Tortured.
Tortured. Might be better than that. Or is that just a stereotype?
Gosh. I'd say that's a question about artists.
It is about artists.
Because we were in the... I was on holiday a couple of weeks ago with my partner, and we were in Amsterdam. We were in the Van Gogh Museum, and the whole thing with Van Gogh is that he's looking at the world and going, "I need to make a picture of what this looks like to me," sort of thing. And I think anyone who's actually an artist has that problem with you've got to describe whatever it is that. The world is making you feel, sort of thing.
I think some writers will be. I think J.K. Emma's favourite daughter will be adopted daughter will be chuffed.
Exactly.
But
she's not. But J.K. Rowling, although she's, I'm sure, got a huge number of very
Sandy
McCullough's great things about her.
Pissed off,
it's
either.
Hard to see her from the point of view of like being an artist, where I'm perhaps. Using that phrase,
so you can't imagine her back in the cafe with the pram.
Oh, what
the
in
coffee,
there?
Cold,
yeah,
cold.
And the chain smoking actually, she always mentioned.
Really?
Yeah.
See, do you think she'd actually been able to write the Harry Potter books then if she couldn't have chain smoked in the cafe?
Oh,
she'd keep going outside and be.
That's a brilliant thought. That
she had a baby with her. So
the smoking ban. The smoking ban might prevent future shit like this coming into the world. Yeah. Yeah, get out of the fucking coffee shop and put your bloody pen down.
Yeah. It's always your break your concentration and stuff. You can't just go like that.
Yeah.
You know, benefit of the thing, I'm trying to smoke a cigarette and feverishly scribble. Yes. Maybe, I don't know. That's a strange one. No, I think a lot of writers are a bit miserable, but they maybe kind of heap that on themselves. I don't.
It's
really
not miserable. Isn't that more that kind of frustrated? Like you perceive the world, you perceive something happening, and you want to make your response to it. And it's like a frustration until you've made an analogue on the page of what you're feeling. That there's a kind of frustration, isn't there? Whether that's a joyous thing, like some of those Van Gogh pictures I'm talking about 2 minutes ago, incredibly joyous. He's looking at a field of flowers, and there's you can just see
bursting with colour.
Completely bursting with colour, and it's spring, and he's just feeling like, it's springtime, there's the sun shining, and the fucking flowers are bang, and
I must express this.
So he's just totally hacking at the page and that with his mad paint and that, and then somewhere it's all heavy and the opposite's happening. But it's always, I think, what marks out, perhaps it's a personal thing, proper, like something that's really got that artistic vibe to it, and not just high quality artisanship. Is that feeling of a frustration that you've really had to, like, they've really needed to express this thing. There's no other way of doing it. Like, you couldn't have written a poem that made the same feeling come across as a Van Gogh picture. Like, it's specifically that feeling, and he's made it that way, sort of thing. So there's kind of, I think that in any, like, sometimes even someone does something quite throwaway in the gun, sometimes what gives it a nice vibe is that someone's obviously, you know, they've really, it's meant something to them to get that thought out of themselves. You know, that's a nice vibe, and that's a nice thing about what you're saying about artists probably do suffer in that, any writer or artist suffers in that moment between having the idea and making it happen on the page or in the, you know.
And I think a lot of writers are quite depressed because they maybe are, you know, that kind of down way because they just know they're not really going to make it to, being realistic, they're not going to make that much money unless they do become big sellers, and who does, really?
Very few, that's right.
Exactly.
But the other thing is, it's just a strange thing to be a human being. Human consciousness is certainly, it doesn't get any easier to grapple with.
No,
it never makes sense.
It's a constant puzzle, surely. I mean, that's, you know, it's like saying why we get into doing the gun and that. Well, we just seem to be doing it.
Aye.
You know, at the end of the day, there's an element, partly perhaps why I was worried that I wouldn't have much to say in this thing, which has been obviously proved totally fallacious. The problem was that I was thinking, well, there's not really a reason that I'm involved, it's just that Craig's my buddy, and it's doing issue 2 was fun, and doing issue 13 was fun, so let's hope doing issue 27 is sort of fun as well, you know?
Well, it should be.